You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com. Hello, everybody. This is Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 57 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. If you have a product, service, or event you'd like to promote, you might want to consider becoming a Clubhouse sponsor. That helps us cover the costs of producing the show, and it lets you reach over 1,500 geeky belly dancers. You can read more about that at bellydancegeek.com/sponsor. And the Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different topic. The reason for that is that it's really easy to find resources for the what. So if you want to learn moves or combos or choreography, there are tons and tons of ways to do that. But if you're looking for help with the why and the how, so things like culture, musicality, business, ethics, all of that can be trickier to get. So besides my guest interview, we always have time for question and answer so that you can geek out too. And if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Dawn Devine, also known as Davina. She's the author of numerous books on costuming and appearance for belly dance. She self-published her first book, Costuming from the Hip, in 1993, and has gone on to publish, co-publish, package, and book shepherd more than 60 publications. In the intervening years, she's taught workshops on self-publishing at events around the U.S. Her latest book, Color Theory with Pencils and Mandalas, is available on Amazon, and you can check her out at her own website at davina.us. That's davina.us. So welcome, Davina.
Hi there.
We are so happy to have you back.
You know, it's a snowy, cold winter day, so I'm really glad to be doing something very uplifting, talking about my favorite subject, self-publishing.
Excellent. Before we jump right into the interview, can you tell us your origin story? How did you get started in belly dance?
So I started in belly dance in 1984. And I was living in Wisconsin. I was a teenager. I discovered belly dance, and it was one of those classes I took because the studio offered it. Long backstory, short front end. I was one of those people who went from class to performance in 6 months. And, you know, that just is frowned upon in this day and age. But in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I was a natural talent. It happened. And made my first costume for my first performance. And the rest, they say, is history. I moved to San Diego in 1985 and studied with Serena, who is a very well-known big name in the San Diego belly dance scene. And I've been performing and teaching ever since.
Excellent. And tell us about how you got into self-publishing.
So self-publishing was something that I actually fell into. I was teaching workshops on costuming to my fellow belly dance students, and, you know, because at that time in 1993, I was just getting started teaching. And I thought the best way for me to start teaching was to teach what I knew best, which was costuming. Arguably a much better costumer than I am a dancer. And so I started off teaching a series of workshops to my belly dance club at the university I was attending, and at UCSD, go San Diego. And so I took the workshop handouts and bound them together, and it became a book. And I didn't know it was hard. I didn't know that it was going to be a challenge. I had no idea about self-publishing. I was just making something that I thought was useful to my friends, and it sort of took off and snowballed from there.
Excellent. So, you know, what's in it for belly dancers who might want to write a book? Why should we do that?
Well, so one of the things that, and, you know, I'm gonna expand this to beyond belly dancers, but creative people who are creating multiple streams of income to fund their subsistence, their lifestyle. Publication is one of the ways that you can add an income stream to your, you know, finances. But it also helps build your credibility and your authority through the act of saying, well, I wrote a book on this subject. You instantly become an authority. And the other thing that I think a lot of creatives do is they use their book as a manifesto for their technique or their theory or as a memoir. So there's lots of reasons how a book can fit into that life cycle of a creative person.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a book can also be something that can reach more people than you can, right? It lets you
Absolutely.
Speak to a wider audience.
Yeah, and I went to England last fall with Sarah Shrapnel and Alicia Westerfeld, and we were publishing, you know, we had published a book together called Becoming a Belly Dancer from Student to Stage. And it was so surprising to me how many dancers I met who already owned copies of my books. And this was in the UK at a belly dance festival, but I didn't realize the impact of my reach. You know, I know the numbers and I talk to people on social media like Facebook and Instagram, but that impact of meeting a dozen people around a table who all brought books for me to sign, it was quite astonishing. And without those books, I wouldn't have touched their lives. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, how about, you know, that you can't reach because, you know, maybe 50 years from now, you're not going to be around. I mean, hopefully we all will be, but who knows?
Well, leaving a legacy is definitely an important thing to consider. I mean, if we go back in history just 100 years, there was no film. Photography is only about 200 years old at this point. Prior to that, there was no photography. So right now, we have the capability to leave a legacy behind that can share future generations, our technique, our mandate, our mission, you know, or just our own personal histories. Future historians, future anthropologists, and future dancers are going to benefit from having this wealth of information to use for their research.
Mm-hmm. I love the idea of thinking of it as a research tool as well, because, you know, all dance grows and evolves, and everybody's going to be curious about, you know, what it was like in different eras. But, you know, you also figure, you know, I can imagine, you know, 30 and 40 years from now, people are going to have totally different tastes in the dance. But having firsthand sources for what we mm-hmm. were doing and what about it and what was important to us just must be so fascinating.
Oh, yeah. The first time I found a copy of my book in a library was it was purchased for the University of Barcelona. And I went into a dance collection in, you know, so my book, my little 100-page, you know, collection of handouts in, you know, 1997 went into its first library in Barcelona. And I was just astonished and you know, like, why? But, you know, in the fullness of time, I've learned that, you know, I write books that are tools, informational tools for people to learn technique. But more than that, there are people researching everything. Think about how many times you've gone, I wonder how they did blank back in the day. You know, what did the dance that Jerome painted in that famous painting of the girl with the sword on her head by Jerome? What was the step that happened before and after that painting? Right. And so, you know, one of the things that a book can do is it can give the future reader information that, you know, can only be, you know, imagined now.
Mm-hmm. All right. And, you know, how do you know when you're ready to write a book?
Well, I think that, you know, people write books for a lot of different reasons. If I had a dollar for everybody who said they wanted to write a book, I would be going on a very long round the world cruise right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people think maybe someday I'll write a book. You know, this tradition of the great American novel, and you know, writing is something that's very accessible that anyone with a pen and a piece of paper can do. But then, you know, if you're going to write a book that is going to sell, then you know, you have to question your motivation. It's really about whether you have something to say and an audience to say it to. And if you have both those things, why not write a book?
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing that I see, you know, among authors certainly, but also, you know, any kind of artist is people not necessarily valuing the expertise that they already have. You know, how can you tell when you have something to say that people want to read?
Well, I'm going to go back to my origin story, that me as a college student in 1980, excuse me, in 1993, I was an undergraduate. What did I know about dance? Do you know what I mean? I really wasn't a master of my craft, but because nobody told me I couldn't do it, I just did it. Nowadays, self-publishing is a thing you can look up on the internet and you can get a metric ton of information about various different self-publishing techniques. And so there's lots of places that say you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. And when I started off, I didn't take into consideration was I an expert or not. What I wanted to do was share my knowledge. And I was looking at a small pool of people, 30 people, maybe 40 people. And it didn't occur to me that that wasn't enough. You know what I mean? Because when you write a book, you don't know how many people are going to buy it. It's always a risk. So the question is how many people would fulfill you as an author? Would 20 people buying it on Kindle fulfill you? Would selling 100 copies fulfill you? And then you weigh that the time versus fulfillment level. If you spend a year writing a book, which you can easily do, spend a year, and then at the end of it, you sell one copy, that might not be fulfilling enough. You know what I mean? So everybody has to think about, their own personal value, separate from the economic value and separate from the intrinsic value of the knowledge. You have to think about your personal value of having and being a published author.
Cool. And when we think about publishing, our topic today is self-publishing, but what options do folks have these days when they want to write a book?
Well, so there's basically two channels. There's traditional publishing through a publishing house, and there's self-publishing. And I'm sure that the rest of this conversation is going to talk about self-publishing. So let me just focus on traditional publishers. In the past, before the internet, before print on demand, before technology made it possible to spread the word about your publications, you would go through a publishing house who would do your marketing, do your advertising, lay it out, actually physically print it, store it, and ship it. And so your publisher did all of these things for you that you could not do yourself. There are many famous people who've self-published in the past. For instance, I love to say Ben Franklin was a self-published author, but he was able to lay out a lot of money and have his books printed at the print shop. He helped lay out the type. This is a different era. But in the last dozen years, and basically since 2007, print on demand technology has increased at such a rapid pace that publishing houses are hurting right now. They're shrinking. They're not necessarily going to go away because there's a use there for major authors like, say, Stephen King, who don't need to have all that, don't need to do it themselves anymore. And also for textbooks and more manually type informational books. Now, of course, a belly dancer is writing in a niche. And so there aren't very many publishers who are working in the small niches anymore. It's really dried up. And so people who are writing books about dance and dance technique and preparation, or in my case, costuming, or even a theory book, most of that kind of publishing is now either at the academic level as collections of essays, or they're being self-published.
All right. So besides, the niche issue, what other reasons would we have to choose self-publishing over traditional publishing?
Well, so for a self-publisher, you have absolute control. And some people absolutely like absolute control, you know what I mean? So you have an opportunity to write the book that you want to write without it being mediated by editors and higher level, people in a hierarchy corporation who are saying, no, that's not a book, rewrite it. You're not going to be told to rewrite it by an external controlling body. You're not going to suddenly discover that your book that you thought you had a contract for has been denied or your contract revoked because it didn't meet the certain standards or it didn't meet their qualifications. Every publishing house has an editorial perspective, and when you self-publish, you don't have to meet anyone else's editorial requirements.
All right, and what are some of the downsides of that, though?
Well, so you have to have a lot of knowledge to self-publish. And while there are lots of information sources on the internet and loads of different companies and people to work with, the downside is that you can do it on a shoestring and learn all that information yourself, or there's the expense of actually paying to have your book packaged. And so, you know, there's sort of that time versus money seesaw, teeter-totter situation. And it can be overwhelming because there's lots of little parts and pieces that a lot of first-time writers don't realize that they have to do the research in the first place. And then once they do the research, then you have to make a choice, you know, which publishing method are you going to use? Is it going to be print? Is it going to be an EPUB? Is it going to be audiobook? Is it going to be a downloadable PDF? You know, there's so many options. And so, you know, it's all about making choices. And every time you make a choice, you narrow down what you're going to do. You can eliminate some of this massive pile of data. But it really is. There's an overwhelming amount of information on the internet today about self-publishing.
Mm-hmm. And with self-publishing, you also take on all the financial risk. Is that not true?
You do, but realistically speaking, if you DIY your book layout and cover, and you DIY, you know, like you have friends who edit for free, and you've got a buddy who's a graphic designer, and you have a friend who's willing to model, and a friend who's willing to take pictures. If you put together a good, strong team who's willing to work with you for the joy of working with you, then you can publish a book for under $100. And so the financial investment can be quite small, actually, surprisingly small. But then if you don't have that good support team, then you have to pay for those parts and pieces, and that's where it can be expensive. In this world of print on demand, you don't pay to have your books printed. The consumer pays to have the book printed. So you don't have any upfront printing fees or storage fees the way you did prior to 2007.
All right. So for folks who are not familiar with print on demand, that just means that instead of ordering, you know, a batch of 100 or 1,000 copies of your book, each one gets made when they get ordered.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's also available in the DVD world, and it is magical. It has opened up so many doors.
Yeah, yeah. It's very interesting to me, you know, CDs, DVDs, anything that a creative individual can produce can be done print on demand now. It's fascinating. And it has been a game changer. But like anything, it's a double-edged sword. There's more competition now. So, you know, there's a sense of anybody can write a book, therefore anybody can write a book. Do you know what I mean? So it's a, it can get, it's a busy world out there.
Great. And, you know, who would you say that self-publishing is a good choice for, and who would not be a good candidate for DIYing it?
Well, I think that, well, so there's two questions there. So self-publishing is good for anybody who's working within a niche, who has information within a specific community. For instance, in our community of belly dance, we are a niche. And then if you write a book that's a niche of a niche, your pool of buyers gets smaller and smaller. And if you're writing to a very small pool, no publishing house will ever take a peek at you. You know what I mean? So I think that self-publishing is the way if you're a niche writer. Now, DIY, that's a different question, because anything that a book requires, you can pay somebody to do. And of course, your personal expenses, because you're self-publishing, it all comes out of your pocket. So imagine, if you will, you had to pay the designer who designed the cover and the layout artist who laid out the text of the book, and you paid a professional copy editor, and you paid a proofreader. It will add up. And so you don't necessarily have to DIY every component, but you do have more choices when you're self-published.
All right. Well, let's jump into the nitty-gritty. So, you know, if we look at how to go about this, first off, what resources do you need if you're going to self-publish your book?
So you need a computer. I think in this modern day and age, the thing that you need the most is a good, solid, dependable computer and a hard drive for you to back up all of your data, because there's nothing more tragic than writing a book and having it disappear overnight. I have been there. It's very sad. But so basically you need an idea. And the idea is the most important part of the what I think of as four steps to self-publishing. The idea comes first. And everything, all the questions that come after the idea, are you going to do it yourself? Are you going to hire somebody? Everything else comes after you have a concept. I think a lot of people go, I want to write a book. And then they go, well, what am I going to write a book about? I want to write a book, but I'm not sure. And so having a clear idea and a title even is really the best place to start. So once you have your computer and your backup hard drive, then you need an idea. And that's where you start.
All right. And in terms of, you know, we mentioned a couple of other things. So we need at least a second line for the editing process, et cetera. What other either skills or human resources do we need?
Okay. Right.
Human resources, so, in the sense of HR, but what do we need to make sure we have access to?
Yeah, totally, totally. So I think every author has to have really getting into the nitty-gritty, you need to have software that you're writing with. That could just be something as easy as a word processor, or it could be a made for authors organizational system like the software Scrivener. So as you write into that software. Then from the human side, once you have a text, I'm going to use the word text not as in textbook, but just words. Once you have your text, your manuscript, then you will hire or borrow people who can do the editing. And there's different kinds of editing. There's self-editing, which everyone should do with their own book before they ever let it leave their house, especially a good, solid read it out loud. Because if you try to read a manuscript out loud and you can't read it, then it's not the grammar's off. And then there's also the two different main kinds of editors that I like to recommend, a content editor who will help you guide and plan sort of the direction the book is going to go. And then you also need proofreaders and copy editors. Copy editors are more structural, whereas proofreaders are more grammatical. But it's nice to have those three kinds of editors in your book writing process.
All right. So, we've talked a little bit about costs already. You said that it is possible to do it for under $100. If someone is going to need to hire out some of these resources, what kind of money could they be spending?
So most editors will charge by the page or charge by the word count. And they come in all different prices. You can get really affordable, but who knows the quality, kind of editors on places like Fiverr or Upworks. You can hire people. You can pitch a project and say, I have this book, it needs proofreading. And somebody will throw their hat in the ring and you can hire somebody that way. There are also editing services that offer packages. So you can hire an editing service. There's thousands and thousands of them on the web. And you can hire a service, and they'll go through it and edit it and run it through, you know, different tiers of pricing based on the level of editing that you require. So you can hire editors off of Craigslist. You know, you type in copy editor or proofreader, and you can find them, you know, locally. Most cities will have editors laying around who are looking for work.
All right. And can you give us an overview of what the self-publishing process looks like? You know, start to finish, what are the big things that we need to be doing?
So once you have your idea and you've written a manuscript, because really those are the two, you know, like, before, you know, there's like a dividing line. There's the conceptual part of it where you're coming up with your idea, you're writing a mission statement about your publication, you're developing a title, you're probably putting together an outline, and then you're filling in the text, and the filling in the text is the writing part. Then once that writing is done, once you have the bones of your book written, then you start working on the editing, the proofreading, the copy editing. And you're also going to look for beta readers, people who are going to read it in advance of it being published and give you honest feedback. And these are, generally speaking, people within your community who are specialists in the area. So I'm a costume maker. I always have three sewers read my book so that they test the sewing part of it. They may not be interested in belly dance or belly dance costumes, but they'll be the ones who say, oh, you forgot to say, now stop and press it. Or you didn't mention how you put that arm, that sleeve into the armhole. You know, they're the people who are going to spot the technical issues. And so beta readers are very important. Once you have all of that editing done, then you move into the world of packaging. And packaging a book involves laying the book out into a book editing, book packaging software. So if you're using a lot of images, you'll need more advanced software like Adobe's InDesign, which is really designed to do page layout and to package books. But if you just have a book that's all text with just a few photos, you can get away with even Microsoft Word or Apple Pages, for instance. And those are good if you're not producing a photo-intensive publication. And then once you have that done, you have to hire somebody or do it yourself to create your cover, your book cover. And then once you have your cover and your interior documents done, because those are two separate documents, once you have those finished, then you will go to the print-on-demand service of your choice and create an account and upload your documents. So I know that sounds a little simplistic, but the steps are all the same. What changes is your choices and who you use and how you use them.
All right. Well, in that case, let's go ahead and walk through that in detail then. So, you know, that first phase is conceptualizing. So what goes into that piece?
Well, so this is where you take some quality time to think about what your message is. What are you trying to say and share or teach? This is where you are deciding what your content is. So I'm going to use you as an example. You're one of the few belly dance podcasters who have a very successful, vibrant podcasting community. So I could see you writing, you know, a 30-page book on how to effectively host a podcast. Now, that wouldn't necessarily be devoted just to belly dance. That might have broader appeal. But you now have the technical expertise after your three years. Have you been doing this?
It's actually been five.
5 years. Awesome.
Yep.
So you have 5 years. You have 5 years of in the trench experience. You know the technology. You know how to prep your guests. You know how to build a community and how to advertise and market. So you have expertise that other people would like to have. So let's say that our mythical book, you're going to write this book, you're going to start with this concept of creating your perfect podcast, and then you're going to create an outline. What would you cover? That's a big brainstorming session. And during that brainstorming session, the chapters of your book will coalesce, you know, so you'll say, oh, I need to do this, I need to do this, I need to do this. These three things all fit under the same category. So you have your big brainstorm where you just dump all the information about podcasting onto a sheet of paper, a big sheet of paper, right? Then you create your outline using all of those pieces that you've brainstormed. And then once you have that outline, then you get to write the book, working through your outline either sequentially. And this is important if you're writing a memoir to go sequentially. But if you're writing a DIY book, like your book on the perfect podcast, you would start off and go, okay, well, I want to write about hosting. I want to write about the guest. I want to write about, you know, Q&A sessions. You can go, because it's not in a particular order, you can write about each of these sections as you see fit. So you have more flexibility with your writing schedule. And of course, you have to schedule in the writing because books don't write themselves. So you kind of got to go, okay, well, I'm going to spend 30 minutes a day writing and pick it up and work on it as you go. Then once you have your manuscript done, that's when you'll contact your editors and your beta readers and get that manuscript out and say, what do you guys think? I mean, what do you guys think? And then you'll get that feedback. You'll make changes. Editing is the most time-consuming process in my experience because editing is about giving and taking. And you have to talk to each of your editors separately and in order. You can't just send out your manuscript to 10 people and then have 10 people's worth of edits come back to you. You know what I mean? Because then you're like, okay, on page 5, I've got 7 edits by this person and 3 edits and 2 suggestions. And folding them in together at that point is a nightmare. So you kind of have to allow yourself a nice long time period where you say, okay, I'm going to give Dawn my manuscript. She's going to read it, and then she'll get it back to me. Then I'll make those changes that Dawn suggested, and then I will send it to Beatrice, and Beatrice will read it. You know, so your edits are going in sequentially and not as a big bulk. And presumably the last person you hand it to is going to go, wow, this is fabulous. I'm totally going to buy it.
And is there a particular order that you recommend doing that in?
Well,
should
so
it, you know,
I
go
to... That, yeah, so I think that content editors come first because they'll help you. Now, these content editors are people who are engaged in the world that you're writing for. So your book, The Perfect Podcast, you'll want to make sure that you have some podcasters in your corner who you can bounce ideas off of. But you're also in this world of belly dance. And so you would want to say, okay, hey, Dawn, you've been on my podcast a couple of times. You have this perspective from the other side of the microphone, as it were. And so I could read it and give you some feedback, but maybe not feedback on the technical information. Do you know what I mean? So content editors might specialize and be able to edit one chunk of your book, but not all chunks of your book. Of course, if you're writing a memoir, then it's just a matter of having people do grammatical editing and copyright editing. Copyright editing, generally speaking, involves more idea-based editing. You know, so somebody goes, well, this seems like it's in the wrong place. That would be a copy editor, whereas a grammatical editor would say you're missing a period or there's two spaces at the end of that line. You know, so they're doing different kinds of things. So the very last one is your grammatical editor. So, yeah, so content editor, then copywriter, then your grammatical editor. And one person can occupy all of these roles.
Cool. All right. So is there anything else in the editing phase, or do you want to talk about the details of packaging next?
Well, so I do want to mention beta readers, because beta readers are people who are going to read the whole manuscript after you've been through that editing process. And the beta readers are going to say, oh, I think this is a good book. Or they'll say, I don't know if I like this. Or I don't know if it's, you know, if you hand the book to somebody and say, well, I'm going to charge $32 for this. They might say, well, I don't know if it's worth $32. Your beta reader might be somebody who will say, you know, I think you've left something out, right? Or also, your beta readers might be somebody who is totally involved in your industry but wasn't involved in the editing process. So, you know, there's lots of podcasters out there. You might send it to somebody like Meredith Vieira over at the Beauty and the Vlog podcast, and you might say, I've been a huge fan of yours. I'm working on this book. What do you think? Do you have time to be a beta reader? And she would, you know, having been on that side of the microphone, she, but not involved in the belly dance world, she might be able to give you a different feedback, but you wouldn't want to give her something that was raw. Do you know what I mean? You wouldn't want to give somebody else, somebody who's in the same field, but not necessarily a product with all the warts and the typos and things still in it. You want to make sure that your beta readers are getting the cleanest possible document.
Mm-hmm. So that would, just to clarify, that's a pretty different role from your content editor or kind of your preliminary reader.
Yes, yes. Your content editor is bouncing ideas around with you before the book is done, whereas a beta reader is getting it in its nearly final state. And the beta reader is not an editor. The beta reader is there to go, okay, I read it. I think it's good. I think your price is right. I think you're on point with the subject. And then the beta reader can write reviews on it. So they can go to Amazon.com and say, okay, I thought this is a great book. I read it. Do you see what I mean? So your beta readers are also the seed group of your review collective. So beta readers are part marketing. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to the packaging section then. So what are the steps that we need to do at this point and it getting into the nitty gritty?
Okay. So packaging, there's many ways to do this. So I'm going to focus on the path that I recommend for brand new first-time writers who don't have a lot of money. So I'm talking to the person who wants to spend under $200 and have a decent book at the end. And the way that I recommend people go, the path that they take, is to set up an account on Amazon's CreateSpace. CreateSpace is a print-on-demand arm of Amazon, and they have set up a very easy-to-understand platform. So if you think of it, it's a whole series of forms that you fill out. Very easy to use, very clean system. And once your book is available, it is instantly on Amazon.com, the third biggest searchable website on the planet, and also available worldwide. So, well, except for Australia. We'll get to Australia in a moment. But Amazon is in Europe, and it's in the Americas, and it's in Africa. Amazon's pretty global, but not quite. So when you have your cover done, right? So you've hired a designer or you've designed it yourself. You want to make sure that that cover looks good as a thumbnail because we live in the thumbnail age. You want to make sure that your book looks stunning as a thumbnail, that you can read it when it's 150 pixels wide so that it looks great and is eye-catching in the flow of text. And this is a relatively new thing. People 50 years ago didn't really worry about the cover, and people 25 years ago were very worried about the cover because most books are purchased in a bookstore. Well, nowadays, most books are purchased online, digitally, and the first image you see is that thumbnail. So you want to make sure that your title is readable in that tiny size. And so it's important, that title is important. Probably more important than the thumbnail because that's what people are searching for. So in today's modern day and age, you want to make sure that your title contains search words, keywords that will help people find your book. For instance, your book, you know, The Complete Guide to the Perfect Podcast has the word podcast right in the title. When I first started, here's a what not to do story from my past. When I first started, I wrote a book called Costuming from the Hip. That's a cute title. That's a wonderful book. It does not say belly dance. So I wrote a belly dance costuming book that didn't say belly dance on the cover. So as the world shifted away from bookstores and into the digital era, my book is hard for people to find. Because when you type in belly dance costumes, my title isn't necessarily going to come up first. So learn my mistake, bad example, a choice made in a different era of publishing. So you want to make sure that your title has keywords and that it's readable at thumbnail size. Then once you have your cover designed, you know, so a cover is generally wraps around. It includes the front, the back, and the spine. You submit your interior pages already laid out and your cover design to CreateSpace. CreateSpace allows you to choose all the details about your book. That's called metadata, the title, the page count, the your publishing house. If you decide to have a publishing house name, you can publish under your name. You can even, if you want to go super discount and save a lot of money, you can just use the CreateSpace imprint, and then the book will say published by CreateSpace. I think it's like $20 or $30. I'm not sure. I haven't done that recently. But if you want to have your own imprint name, so for instance, my company is called Ibexa Press, and our imprint name costs a little bit more money to set the book up because I'm the publisher of record, not CreateSpace. And then you can also buy your ISBN number through CreateSpace. Now, there's ways of buying your ISBN number separately that cost a lot more money, but you can buy just one ISBN number from CreateSpace at a time and have it applied to your book. So you will buy...
Can I interrupt you for just a second?
Your account. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yep. Will you explain to folks what an ISBN number is in case they haven't run into that?
An ISBN number. So when you look at any book and you flip over and you look at the back and you see the barcode on the back, that barcode is the International Standard Book Number, the ISBN. And every book on the planet that is distributed by a book distributor, publisher, or bookstore has to have an ISBN number and barcode on the back. It's a standardized book selling feature, and you have to have it. So when you go through a company like CreateSpace, and there's other, I'm just using CreateSpace as our example, and there's other ones available, but when you buy your number, they assign you a number. The numbers are actually, this is a bit of an aside, the numbers are distributed in America by a company called Bowker, B-O-W-K-E-R. And Bowker is in sort of a government spinoff. You know, they're not really the government, but they work with the government to make sure that every single book has a unique number. And so they're the organization of record that sells and distributes ISBN numbers. So when you buy your number from CreateSpace and you're getting just one number, it's actually coming from Bowker. And you buy this number, it is a unique identifier to that particular book. When you decide to get a Kindle book, right, because your podcast book, you want to sell it on Kindle, you wanted it to be a $4.99 impulse buy that everyone buys, right? So you'll want to release it as a print book, but you'll also want to make it a Kindle book. It will get another ISBN number for the Kindle version because the ISBN number has all of your metadata attached. So the style of publication or the method of publication, whether it's digital or print, is part of that metadata that's associated with your ISBN number. Does that make sense?
It does. And also, isn't it different for different editions? So like, let's say my podcast book is wildly successful in 10 years, everything has changed, and I put out an updated version. That would have a different number too, right?
Yes or no. So there's some little qualifications. If you change the name, you will have to change the ISBN number. So if you say volume 2 or second edition, you have to change the name. If you are going to make changes that result in less than 10%, and this is a weird number, right, 10% of change, then you don't have to get a new ISBN number. But if the page count changes, you need a new ISBN number. If you make more than 10% substantial changes to the text of the book, then it has to change number. I am working on a reboot of Costuming from the Hip, my first book. It will have the word belly dance on the cover this time. Anyways, I will have to get a new ISBN number for it. So, and then all those books that have been out there floating around for the last 20 years will become collector's items. Yay. But,
I have one.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. You bought me a coffee. Yay. So, So as I rework that book to bring it into the modern era, to the new century, it's going to expand. It's going to change by, well, 90% changes. So I will definitely have to buy a new ISBN number. Oh, and the word belly dance, adding that to the cover, total game changer. So, yeah. So ISBN numbers also can help you identify when and where books are selling. So some publishers will like do A/B testing to test out whether a book with this title or that title sells better. So for instance, you might have the same book and one version is called The Complete Guide to Podcasting. And that might sell better than, you know, your perfect podcast, right? So you might have this desire to have two books with two slightly different titles to appeal to different markets. So another thing that publishers do, sometimes a little bit hinky, you know, it's like, oh, but you have to like stay on your information in the front matter. The front matter is the first part of the book that includes the title page, but also your copyright page. If the book has been released under multiple titles, you have to list that on your copyright page for full disclosure. Still a little sneaky, but it is done by publishers all the time. Not by self-publishers usually, because we don't have the money to splash around to buy three or four ISBN numbers per book. So once you have your book and, you know, the perfect podcast is ready to go, we have a gorgeous title, we have the word podcast in it, we have a cover that's gorgeous, we've bought our ISBN number, we've set up our account on CreateSpace, and you're ready to rock and roll. So you will upload your documents, your two documents, the cover and the interior. It will go through it gets run through an analysis where they determine if it is pornography or not, or they determine that it's a mistake. So for instance, I put out books with lots and lots and lots of pictures. My books are very photographic intensive. And so it will tell you, hey, the image on page 63 is too low resolution, right? Or it will say, you know, this book has inappropriate content if you've used, you know, included something pornographic, because frankly, Amazon stays away from pornography. That is not our issue, but we still have to go through the process. So it can take 3 to 4 days to go through that process. Then you're required to buy a printed proof if you're printing it. So they will print a copy and send it to you. You pay for that. It costs $7.50 plus shipping. And so your book will come, and then you'll flip through it, and you'll go, oh, I got to change a lot of stuff. Because that first time you see your book in print, you're going to go, oh, the text is a little close to the margin, or, oh, that picture is grayscale, and it's a black and white book, but I didn't grayscale it with enough contrast, you know, that kind of thing. So then you take your book and you tweak it. Maybe you don't have any tweaks. Maybe it's just a book with text and the text is fine. It passes muster. And then you press a button that basically says go. Press the button that says go. And boom, your book is on Amazon within 3 days. So once you're on Amazon, you're part of the third biggest search engine behind Google and YouTube, you know, Amazon, Google, and YouTube, that's where you want to be. And your book will then be there with all your information ready for your beta testers to dash over and write great reviews. And so, and that's the process in a nutshell. Now, Amazon also, if you go through CreateSpace, there's also the Kindle department. And so you can just push your documents over to the Kindle department, and it will convert it to a Kindle book, like seamlessly. And the more pictures you have, the uglier that Kindle book will look. I will attest, I've tried to Kindle my books. People ask me all the time, why aren't your books available on Kindle? Kindle really isn't good for pictures. So, but if you have a book that's text and the occasional pictures, with the occasional picture thrown in, Kindle is just fine. And it opens up yet another income stream. And Kindle is wonderful because you can price your a product at really low profits. So, for instance, just going into a little profit aside here, if you publish a book, I'm going to use myself as an example. I publish a book and I want to make $8. Okay, that's my goal. I want to make $8. So the book costs $4 to print, right? So now that's $12. And then it has to be doubled so that Amazon can make its cut and everybody else down the lane can make their cut. So you need to price for profit. Well, with Kindle, there's no printing cost, there's no shipping cost, which means you can make that $8 by just pricing it, you know, slightly above $8 so that Amazon can get its little digital slice of cash, right? Because you're paying to be on the website with every purchase. So fortunately for us, the book pays for itself. So you are only receiving money from Amazon. Once you set up your book, you never have to pay them anything.
And just to be clear, we say that we're not paying them anything. We mean that they're taking a cut of the profit. We're not paying out of pocket.
Right. So basically, it's a royalty situation. So every book that Amazon sells, Amazon gets a royalty on. So just like if you had gone through Random House, if you go to Random House, they would pay you per sale of the book, maybe 50 cents a book, maybe $2 a book. On Amazon, Amazon is charging you, I think right now it's about a 40-60 split on the cost of a book. So when you see a book that's $22.95, you know, you divide that in half and then subtract the print cost. Do you see? So there's, instead of having somebody pay you a fraction of your book, you're splitting your the cost.
And if this all
And you
sounds like
get
a
to
lot of
put,
math, folks, I
yes.
also use CreateSpace. I do it for my DVDs. And when you set up your title, they will tell you what your profit is going to be on each one when you give them the price. So it, you know, it's
Yes.
not a, the math is actually not something you have to worry about. They will show it to you as you go.
No, but it's very important to know that's going to be there. I've had people come to me and go, "Well, Amazon's taking all my money." And I'm like, "No, actually, Amazon's giving you money in the form of a payment for each sale. If you don't use them, then you don't have to, you know, you don't have to split with them. You don't have to use that platform." But then you're also not making sales to that platform. So some people are shocked by how high that slice is. Do you know what I mean? So it's good to know that it is there. And it does vary from product to product. It does vary a lot. And you have control ultimately of your own final price point. So if I want a book to sell for $22, then I need to make adjustments in my world in order to make that $8 profit, right? So you're right. The CreateSpace, again, it takes all the questions out of it because they have calculators that are built into their software that plug in the numbers for you and give you data from which you make choices.
All right, so we've talked conceptualizing and writing and packaging, but there's also the marketing end. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. So I always start off this conversation with going back to the idea. And the reason why is because books don't sell themselves. Nobody is going to randomly find your book. Well, maybe they will. Maybe they'll do a search and randomly find your book. But this is the opposite of that adage, if you build it, they will come. No. You have to build a platform as an author to sell your product. And this is the way it works for every product. This isn't just for books. This is for DVDs or classes or any of those things. Most professional dancers already have a platform in place and are adding a book to their platform. Very few people are starting with the book first in the world of belly dancing. But you want to have a book title that you're going to be happy saying for the rest of your life, because you'll be using that book title and saying that book title for the rest of your life. It will become associated with you. You will be talking about it. You will develop all kinds of marketing material. So you better like your cover a lot, and you better really enjoy saying the name of your book, because once you start promoting it, you're never going to escape it unless you get out of the publishing game. Like you can totally turn your back on it and say, hey, I'm not going to promote my book. I'm just going to let it, you know, sell one every other month for the rest of my life, you know, with no promotion. But I think most people go through the effort of writing a book, editing the book, packaging the book. They want to make something in the end. They want to make some money. And so they're the first and foremost thing is to love your title, love the thumbnails, and get used to the notion of selling. Because as a business person, I have a product. My product is a book. And so I'm going to strategize how I'm going to present my book to the world in the most enticing manner possible, that the most people will purchase it. Now, we live in a niche in the world of belly dance, and your niche is the perfect podcast. And so you're going to be saying, I've written the book about the perfect podcast. So if you have a stutter and two P's in a row are a problem, you wouldn't want to pick that title. You know what I mean? I picked the title Costume from the Hip because I thought it was cool when I was 20. That sounded really cool to me. Now that I'm 50, it sounds a little cheesy, and it doesn't have the word belly dance in it. So as you think of and conceptualize your book, think about saying that title every day of your life for the rest of your life. Okay, so that's number one. So that's the jump back to the idea. So now that we're in promotion, you really need to think of your marketing as building a platform and then presenting the platform to the world. So there's the build phase and then the presentation phase. The build phase includes a website. It might include a storefront, like an Etsy storefront, for instance. It might include a podcast, a YouTube channel. It might include Facebook interactions and other social media, Instagram. I don't know what's popular right now, Tumblr. It could be Snapchat. I don't know. You will pick what goes into your platform. You'll need to be able to talk in an articulate way with people. You know, you'll need to like smooth this sort of hesitation out so that when you're talking about your book, you have an elevator pitch and then a longer pitch, and then you have your hour workshop pitch. And think about how you are going to be presenting this forever. And then once that platform is built, then you're quote-unquote tending your garden. You have to maintain that in regular activities. So, yeah. So there's the platform, then there's the tending it forever. So,
and what would tending it look like?
Well, so from in my world, because I'm my own worst example here, in my world, it is having a newsletter. I just sent out a newsletter last night to promote this podcast. So I sent out a timely newsletter the night before to say, hey, everybody, I was on this podcast before. It's awesome. I'm going to be on this podcast again tomorrow if you're available. And you can link to it on iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. And that is tending my garden. My garden being the people who are part of my fan base, my friends, my family, and anybody who I have the ability to touch. It also means going on to today Facebook, and I made a graphic that said, hey, I'm doing this thing tonight. Everybody come and join me. And if you can't join me tonight, check it out on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And so I put it into strategically placed those things around Facebook and the groups that I manage, so I knew that the person wouldn't knock me off for self-promotion. You know, it's always nice to have your own group so you can promote yourself to your you know, mm-hmm. Beeps. And then I also put it onto Instagram and Tumblr and Twitter. And I tried to reach as many people as I possibly could in the 24-hour lead up to this presentation with you. And that is how I tend my garden. Now, the reason I call it a garden is because every social media outlet is a walled garden. For instance, people on Facebook don't see everybody they're friends with. You only see about 90 people at any given time. And the people you interact with, you see more often. And so it's really got walls and barriers between your access. And as a professional in the world, you know, Facebook really wants you to buy ads. They really, really want you to buy ads. So if you're trying to do this on a shoestring, you know, you have to find ways of circumventing the walls. And that's where having groups that you're active in really helps, because you're accessing people crossing a wall. But every social media is a walled garden. You might create the walls yourself, but you can't access the entire world with a tweet. That's just not realistic. And you can't reach everyone with a Facebook post, even if they're your friend. So you kind of have to like tend to these gardens and touch them on a regular basis. So I do, because of the nature of my books, I do blogging. As an author, writing should come somewhat naturally, and so blogging feels like a good 1-2 punch with publishing books. In my blog, I can talk about things that are related to my book, but not necessarily in the pages of my books, and I can talk about things like this upcoming event today. So there's a blog post, there was a newsletter, there was, you know, touching all the social media, and so that's what I mean by tending my garden. Mm-hmm.
All right. And, you know, what about in-person activities? You know, for example, one thing that I could see that's an example that I experienced is that my teacher wrote a book soon before she stopped teaching. She printed it herself off at Kinko's and had it spiral bound. It was very, very self-published. Mm-hmm. Now you can get it much more professional. And she sold it to us. You know, and so even things, you know, like including it in packages for new students when they sign up. Or selling it to your folks, it's, you know, at workshops. Are there related other things other than kind of the larger social media marketing that you think are worth doing?
Oh, absolutely. I think that one of the things that I really enjoy doing is going to belly dance festivals and events. And I have a tote bag that has the cover of whatever the latest book I'm pimping. So, for instance, I'm still carrying my Becoming a Belly Dancer book because Poppy Maya's face is just so gorgeous, right? So I've got this gorgeous girl on my bag. So people ask me, "What? Tell me about your bag. What's up with this?" And in that bag, I have, you know, a book or two, business cards, flyers, information that I can hand them. And again, this is an expense, you know. So I as an experienced publisher, I have a postcard that has strategically placed 8 book covers on it. So I've got the maximum impact, and then my current book will be on a business card. And then, you know, I'll add business cards for each book until I get to another phase where I can put together another postcard that has multiple pictures on it. So I always try to have business cards for my book, a one sheet, which is used by the publishing industry, and a one sheet has the cover of the book, all of the book details and facts, and a summary. And so one sheet is used by the book industry, and so I produce those as well. I think people in the belly dance world kind of look at them and go, oh, this is kind of ugly and not very colorful, but they're very informative. And so I try to have those as well. And
let's say you're going to a big festival and you wander over to, say, like the bellydance.com table, and you're talking to them and they ask you about your tote bag. I bet they want the one sheet if you're going to carry your book.
Absolutely. Well, Meher does. Meher is wonderful at supporting the belly dance community and carrying a book selection. So shout out to bellydance.com and Meher. Woohoo!
I love them.
That's how my relationship with them started, was me walking up to them at Ricasa in Oakland, California, many years ago now, and saying, hey, would you guys carry my book? And so it came to pass, and my book is on their website. And I know that if I publish a new book, they might be interested. I just go ahead and I send it to them. They're on my PR release list. Now, PR release list is something that you'll develop over time. You know, it's not something you can buy online. But in our world, you would think about who are the big movers and shakers. Who are you going to send your book to if you want somebody to review it? You know, are you going to send it to another author and say, hey, I'll review your book if you review mine? Are you going to send it to an event promoter and say, I would like to send you a dozen books to put in your raffle or giveaway? Right? So every time they do a raffle, they're saying your name. You know what I mean? So there's this notion of doing this research to find out who are people who will promote you in return for you promoting them, you know, like you and I talking. I know you haven't written this perfect podcast book, but I'm looking forward to it.
Now I think I should.
We've talked about it. Yeah, I really think you should. Not that I'm pushy or anything, but I think it's a good idea.
It is a good idea. I'm doing another one right now, so it's going to be a little while. But
Fantastic. So when you're doing direct sales, you can go whole hog and do book tours where you visit different cities and promote. Or you can also tie your books into what I call, well, not I, everybody calls, back of the room sales. So if you're teaching on any subject, say I'm teaching at the WorldCon, the World Science Fiction Convention, I'm going to teach a class on self-publishing there. Nobody who comes to my workshop is going to be interested in belly dance costumes, you think? But I always have some books at the end of the show, at the end of my talk, and say, I write books on belly dance. If any of you know a belly dancer, you might be able to pick up the perfect present now. And so while they came for my self-publishing talk, I can generally make one or two sales to somebody who's like, oh, my Aunt Gertrude is a belly dancer, or, you know, my niece Sarah took belly dance and really loves it, you know. So there's always a sense that regardless of where you are, you might be able to make a back-of-the-room sale, even if you're talking about a totally different subject.
Mm-hmm. And if the thing that you've written about is something that you talk about, let's say you teach workshops to belly dancers on this, then that can be a really good supplement. You know, people will always buy the DVD of the workshop you just taught them. It's magic.
Absolutely. Because, you know, because memory is, we all know as humans, we do not have the best memory. And so when we get home, we'll be like, what was that combo? What was that combo she taught? Or where do I buy my ISBN number from? Or I know she used interfacing. What type of interfacing did she use? Those are the kinds of things that you put into your book that you say when you're teaching or you demonstrate when you're teaching, but can be referenced in a publication. And so it's really useful as a teacher of any knowledge to have a book on that knowledge. Even if it's just a 20-page handout that you've printed yourself and you're selling for $5, buy this note, buy these handouts, buy this, you know, give me $5 and I'll sell you this card that has a download code to download a book when you get home. You know, so there's lots of ways that you can, you know, add value to your presentations and add income into your wallet when you have a publication.
Mm-hmm. All right. So was there anything else that you wanted to add about marketing?
Well, so I want to go back just a second. I'm just going to take a little step back. One of the things I mentioned at the beginning, and then, you know, we talked about traditional publishing and self-publishing. One of the ways that you can self-publish is via a downloadable and printable PDF. And this is the easiest kind of publication to sell directly from your website, because nobody gets a cut of that but you, because it's on your website. And so if you have a really high traffic, big ticket website where you're getting 400 or 500 people a day coming to your site, you could present your book as a downloadable PDF and then do all social media marketing and in-person marketing but direct everybody to that download on, you know, behind a code, locked, sealed away on your website, so that people can access it at home, download it, and utilize it on their own facility, whether it's digitally or if they want to print it out. And this is a way of, if you're thinking about doing a book and you don't know if you have enough reach or enough impact or enough knowledge, you could do something small to get your feet wet. With, I mean, it doesn't need an ISBN number. It doesn't need to be recorded for the Library of Congress in publication. It doesn't, you know, there's all kinds of things that are stripped bare when it's just a downloadable PDF. And you can still use a sales site like Etsy. Etsy now lets you put up downloadable PDFs for sale. So if you don't even want to conduct the sale directly on your website, you can put it onto Etsy and you can sell it that way. Etsy takes a small chunk compared to Amazon. Etsy takes a small chunk for the privilege of being on their website, but you also don't have to set up your own credit card processing and set up your own shopping cart on your website. So you could have a very simple blog and sell a product, a published book, without going through all those extra steps. And that's a great place to start.
I have an ebook that I did that way. I just did it in Word, saved it as PDF. Very easy. But it's a very good way to do it. I agree.
Yeah. And it's that third method that we really didn't talk about at length, but it's also it's a very easy way to get your toe wet. And it's a small bite. I think of a book as being an elephant, and to get to the end of the elephant, you take a bite every day. Well, you know, it's more like a, you know, like a bunny rabbit. You know, it's a smaller publication, so it takes fewer bites, and you get to the end, and then you can go, whoo, I wrote that book. Do I want to write something bigger? Do I want to invest more time and energy? In the course of that, you might discover, yeah, I'm a writer. You might discover, heck no, never again. I'm going to stick to DVDs. I'm going to produce music. I'm going to find another way to add an income stream to my belly dance income.
But for all time, you will be able to say, I'm so-and-so, author of this book. And that's going to support
Absolutely.
Everything else you do.
It does add, it adds social proof. It proves that you have the knowledge, whether you feel comfortable or whether other people, like, I had this conversation with somebody who says, well, we all know you. And I'm like, yeah, but when I wrote Costume from the Hip in 1993, I was a college student. Nobody knew me. I was nobody. And it's only in the fullness of time, because I didn't give up, because I decided I liked writing, that I became this huge self-published author. And now I work as a book Sherpa, helping other people self-publish their books. You know, that never would have happened if I just didn't have that sort of balls to the wall, I'm going to do it, let's do this thing. And so, yeah, so it's one of those things where if you don't know if you're into writing enough to have a full-fledged book on Amazon, then you do the PDF on your website, sell it through Etsy, sell it using PayPal from, you know, links on Facebook, and, you know, keep it low and small and give it a go.
And you can always turn that into your bigger book if you
Absolutely.
Want to.
Absolutely.
It's a great place to start.
Yeah. 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 I wrote a book once called Cloth of Egypt, All About a Suit, which is a book all about the cloth, a suit. And that started off as a college research project. I mean, that was a 40-page research paper that became a 200-page book. And, you know, you never know what you're going to write, whether it's a blog post or even something as tiny as a tweet that might inspire you to write an entire book on that subject.
So. All right. Well, before we move on to the question and answer, just a couple more things. One is, what are the biggest mistakes that people make when they self-publish? What do people really need to watch out for?
Okay. So without naming names, because that's just mean, I'm going to make a list of some errors. Some of these are my own errors. Some of these are errors from other books in the world of belly dance. Number one, you want to make sure that you proofread your book. If somebody picks it up and they spot 10 or 15 typos, they're going to question your authority. They're just going to question your authority. This person can't even write. What, she has no business writing, right? I don't care what she has to say. So make sure that at the very least you run your publication through spell checker and that you read it out loud so that it sounds like English and it has a cadence that's readable. So that's number one. Proofread, run it through spell check. Number two, read your book out loud. Number three, use best quality photos that you have. Print quality is 300 DPI at the size that you're printing. So if you're printing a 5x7, it needs to be 5x7 at 300 DPI. If it is not at that level, it will be fuzzy, 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 and it will make your bring down the quality level of your book. It'll make it look like you didn't care enough to get really good images. Now, the caveat there is if you're going into the historic archive and you're using old archival images, people are okay with a slightly blurry archival image. But people are not okay with modern, taken today images that are blurry. So make sure you have the best quality images. I recently saw a belly dance book that had dates on the photos. Like they were using a point and shoot camera that inserted a date onto the image and they didn't remove that date. So make sure that your images don't have dates on it because those dates are dated. You know, we don't, that doesn't look like a published image. That looks like shoddy workmanship. It looks like a snapshot that was taken with the date feature on and it wasn't processed properly. The other thing that happens, especially in belly dance publications, is that the pictures are very, very dark because they're taken in nightclubs or they're taken at night. You know, you want to make sure that you brighten and lighten and white balance your pictures. So you'll need a few photo editing skills in order to make your photographs really shine. And you need to have higher contrast images for black and white publications. If you're doing color publications, which are truly, truly expensive, but you can do it. If you're doing color, you need to white balance and you need to make sure that you do several rounds of proofing to make sure that the skin color is actually skin color. Because a lot of times you have to tweak it a little peachier or a little yellower in order for the print quality of the book to come out with the right level of color. So photography is a big make or break it moment. So you want to make sure that you do the best that you can with the materials and supplies that you have. The other thing I think that is important is that when you organize your book, that you move through the chapters or the sections in a very logical way. There have been some wonderful sort of memoir type books. If you're going to do a memoir, then make sure it's chronological, it follows a timeline, or it's presented in chapters where each chapter is a scenario or a story, sort of like a storybook. I think one of the great examples of that is Princess Farhana's book. She wrote a book, I can't recall the name off the top of my head, but it's stories of her as a showgirl confidential. I think that's what it's called. And it's full of little anecdotal stories. She did a fabulous job. She's the great example of a belly dance publisher doing it right. And but having a cadence, you know, all those stories were about the same length. All those stories had the same voice. And so you want to make sure that whether you're following a timeline or you're creating stories, that it has a good ebb and flow. Nothing will seem stranger than if you write your memoir, but you're missing 10 years out of it. What happened during those 10 years? Oh, you didn't dance? Well, tell us you didn't dance. Tell us that story. Another thing, I'm going to go back to pictures for a moment. Make sure that you have a really good author portrait that's realistic and looks like you today. Don't use a picture from 20 years ago, even if it's a memoir. You know, so some dancers are using ancient photography and they don't reflect what they look like today. I mean, nobody wants to age, but by the same token, if you're a 50-year-old dancer like me, I'm a 50-year-old dancer. I have wrinkles and bags under my eyes. If those wrinkles and bags under there, nobody will trust that I actually wrote that book. So a little photo touching is okay. You know, a little Photoshop is okay. Don't push it into the uncanny valley of, oh my gosh, she's turned into Gumby dancer. You know, so be very a light touch with the anti-aging photo techniques. And then, of course, be really clear on your message. The most difficult thing as far as the marketing, I mean, you can write a book on anything, but when it comes time to market it at the end, the more clarity you have about what your project is and does and how it relates to the world at large, then you have a place to start a conversation. I mean, if your book, The Perfect Podcast, when that book comes out, it'll be the first book written by a belly dance podcaster, maybe, you know, if you get on that. But you know, you'll be able to say, I, you know, at the time of writing, I have all this experience. You're not going to use a picture from when you were a baby dancer. You know, you're going to talk about, you know, how the podcast happened and how, but you're going to show the timeline. You're going to share with people this arc of age because that age gives you credibility. You know what I mean? So you want to be crystal clear on who you are and what you're presenting. So don't hold anything back. Don't hold anything back. Unless you lived in a leper colony and you've lost your finger, you might want to hold that one back. But I don't
That
know.
sounds like
That
a
could
good
be
story,
cool
though.
too. Yeah, I know. I'm like, no, I want to hear that story too. People really want to hear the stories. They want to learn and they want to relate. You know, I didn't write the first costuming book. I was inspired by a costuming book that I got when I was young. It was wrapped in gold. It was Zarifa Erdoon's book, the gold belly dance costuming book. I can't remember the title off the top of my head. But that book inspired my book because I couldn't buy a copy. I saw it, somebody had it, I couldn't buy a copy. So I put my own book together. And that book spawned my book. And I like to give Zarifa Erdoon credit. And now I live where she used to teach. You know, I live in the Bay Area where she used to teach. And I tell people, yeah, the gold book, that inspired my entire career. You know, so those kinds of stories make you very real and genuine. You know, there's nothing a little more off-putting to a reader than to have mysteriously sprung like a mushroom out of the lawn and not acknowledging other dancers or your dance history or who or what have come before you. And unfortunately, I've recently read some books where it's kind of like, oh, okay, you invented belly dance. I'm not buying that. Sorry. You know, so, you know, there's kind of a sense of acknowledging the world as a whole and having clarity about your point of view at the same time. And that's a tricky balance sometimes. So I could keep going on forever and ever. I mean, I feel like I'm like la la la. Oh, and don't forget this. Oh, and don't forget that. And I think that
That's all good
anybody
stuff.
thinking about if anybody's thinking about writing a book, get your blog on right now. Don't even think about it. Just go to WordPress, get a free WordPress blog on WordPress.org, and start today. You don't need to spend a lot of money on your website. Just get into the habit of writing every day or every other day. Get your name started. Have a pool of articles that you can reference in other social media. If you're going to write a book, we're going to want to see the blog posts that led up to that book. You know what I mean? You don't want to just come out of nowhere with, oh, I've written a book. You know, the Perfect Podcast has this wonderful podcast history. You know, there's 50 plus podcasts in the bank and growing, right, with hundreds of subscribers. So you have this proof, the social proof. But if somebody comes out of the blue and is like, oh, I want to do a book about working with fabric and veils, and then we want to see some veil videos. We want to read some veil blogs. We want to see where you have come from. Don't just be that mushroom springing out of nowhere. So get a blog, Cheap, super cheap. Don't worry about your name. Don't worry about a special name. Don't micromanage it. Just, use your dance name. And if that dance name is taken, tweak it until it's not, and set up a blog. I have a blog. It's hidden. It's not hidden. It's out in plain sight. But I have a blog that I use when I'm teaching this as a workshop. And I say, look, go to DavinaDivine.me. That's me. It's a travel blog, right? Blog, so it's just got pictures, travel pictures. That costs me $36 a year total. That's it. It's got my own name and it's got, it's $36. And I add to it when I can, when I want. And I use it as this example. Go to WordPress.org, set something up. Domain hosting for a year is $36. Why not? People say websites are too expensive. Why not? Do it free. Do it cheap. Anything else?
Excellent. I think we're just about ready to move on to questions. But before we do that, if there's one thing that people were to take away from this call, what would you want that to be?
Let's see, the one thing. I'm going to quote a major corporation. Just do it. The worst case scenario is that it doesn't work out. But if you don't try, you won't know. If you don't do it because of fear, because of money, because of whatever obstacle you put between you and the goal, there's so many reasons not to do it. Just do it. Be fearless. Because at the end of the day, you'll have this publication that you can share with people. Even if you never make a dime, you will have this accomplishment that you can claim and share and use in your world. And this doesn't just apply to dance. You could write a book about making doll clothes or a book about surviving a plane crash. You can write a book about anything. There's this phrase that I've heard bandied about at sort of these social marketing things, the riches are in the niches. We are in a niche, and there is so much craving and hunger for knowledge and information. If you don't write your book, somebody else will. And so write it. Just do it.
All right. And if people want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
All righty. Well, my name is Dawn Divine. My dance name is Davina, and my website is www.davina.us. I write books on how to design and make belly dance costumes, and am branching off into other places, including I wrote a book on the history of sills. We talked about that in the last podcast I attended. I think that was 48, I think, maybe. And
That
but
sounds right.
I just released a book called Color Theory with Colored Pencils and Mandalas, which is part of a class I'm going to put up on the Belly Dance Business Academy in 2018 called Think Like a Designer. It's my college course that I've taught for many years. Basically, it's Fashion 101, but totally aimed at the belly dancer. So learn how to think like a designer from soup to nuts to create your own costuming. So that's next on my agenda. And of course, you heard me mention in this talk that I'm rewriting Costuming from the Hip for the New and Modern Age. So Costuming from the Hip is coming up soon. And because I'm a collaborative soul, I am working on a book called Strike a Pose, A Dancer's Guide to Making the Most of Her Next Photo Shoot. And it's geared towards all those dancers who need publicity images, who need documentation of their dance journey, or are hobbyists who just want to have great pictures. My co-author, Alicia, we worked on Cloth of Egypt. We worked on becoming a belly dancer from student to stage. She's a fabulous photographer. We're co-authoring this book in a kind of better, bigger, better, best. So a nice picture, tweaking the pose into a better picture, tweaking the pose into a superlative picture, how it works, things to think about, how to plan, how to hire a photographer, all those sort of nuts and bolts about planning your photo shoot, practicing your poses, and putting together the perfect costume for your next photo shoot. So that'll be the next book. Book, class, book, 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 all the stuff. And yeah, I have a group on Facebook called Studio Divina Behind the Themes, where we talk about sewing. So if somebody's interested in belly dance costuming, you can find us there hanging out and talking. But I am also easy to get a hold of. I spend a couple hours every day on social media tending my garden. And so if anybody wants to reach out, you can email me, you can message me via Facebook or Instagram, or yeah, I'm easy to find.
Excellent. All right. So we are going to
Yeah.
open it up to questions and answers. So if anybody would like to
Okay.
ask a question about something that we learned or ask Davina for some advice or just take away your story, we would love to hear from you. So if you are just on the webcast, you should be able to click on the mute button over your tile to unmute yourself. If that doesn't work, or if your mic isn't working, you can also type in a question on the right. There's a little speech bubble. It looks like a square speech bubble with three dots, and that will give you a panel where you can ask some questions. Or if you're on the phone or on Skype, you can press star star to unmute yourself. We would love to hear from you, so please jump right in.
Yeah.
This is the part where we wait for the first person to be brave. Nobody ever wants to be first.
Well, I just want to say I understand not wanting to be first. Who ever does? But I sometimes think, wow, we've done such a good job covering the subject. We filled them up.
I also feel like sometimes it's like, what is it, like the good version of cockroaches? They say if you see one, there's 100 lurking. It's kind of like if one person asks a question, there were 10 people who were thinking the same thing.
Right. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we've got, oh, here we go. We've got a caller, possibly from Connecticut.
You have a taker.
Hi.
My name is Jane. I'm from Connecticut. And
Hello.
unfortunately,
Hi, Jane.
I got back
I'm sorry, I'm going to
so.
interrupt for just a second. It looks like we've got
Sure.
another caller from California. We're just going to mute you for a second, but I'll unmute you
Sure.
next. So, sorry, go ahead, Jane.
I was so sorry. I called in so late because I got hung up. And I just would like maybe a few sentence summary of what you talked about. I got here so late.
Today we talked about self-publishing. There are four phases of the self-publishing process: idea or conceptualization, writing, packaging, and then promotion. And we talked a little bit about each of those four areas.
What a shame. I'm working on a book, and I will be self-publishing it. And
Good luck.
relatives buy it, then that's, or I give it to relatives, that's just fine. So it's how to find a company if I want to self-publish. Did you talk about how to go about finding the best company to publish your book?
Well, so when you are a self-published author, you're not actually looking for a publishing company. What you're looking for is somebody that will distribute your books. I talked at length about CreateSpace, which is a division of Amazon.com, and that's who I used for my print-on-demand needs. And so I
Great.
am the publisher of record, and I get a percentage of each sale. I set my own price, which means I'm determining my own profit levels, and it allows me access to the third biggest search engine on the web. So, yeah, I always recommend people start with a CreateSpace. There are many other choices. If you search around, there's many choices. It's hard to pick, but I did all that research, and CreateSpace really has proven to be very, very lucrative for me.
So that sounds like that should be maybe the first place I should look when I'm complete. It's close to completion. Oh,
yep.
Thank
I'll
you.
I'll include a link there. We'll the show notes. We'll have the link there too. And we also will be sending recordings to you as well, because Davina did get into quite a lot of detail about that you'll definitely want to hear.
Oh, I'll definitely want the recording. Thank you so much.
Thank you for
my
calling.
My pleasure. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and put you on mute now. And we had another caller. You're showing up as coming from San Jose, California, but that might also mean Skype. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute you again. All right. Would you say hello so we can hear you?
Yeah.
Hi, Hella. How are you doing? Yep.
I'm doing great. Hi, Davina.
So I'm Hi. Calling,
hey. Regarding the blog, so you said the first thing to do is the blog. So what are your suggestions for directing traffic to the blog?
So first off, so it's a three-step process. Your first step is to build a blog and get some content up. So you want to get a month in. Maybe you blog every week or you blog twice a week. So you want to have a pool of articles. Then once you have that pool of articles, you know, sort of started and you've established it, then you want to go to social media and start sharing it with people. And whether it's Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, those are all avenues that you can use to promote. I personally think that there's a very large, active, and vibrant belly dance community on Facebook. So you want to share your blog on Facebook with as many belly dancers as you can connect with. And the rest will spiral from there. But your first step is to start the blog and get about a month's worth, maybe 5 to 10 blog posts ready, so that when somebody comes to your blog, there's more than one thing for them to see.
Okay.
And when you're starting out, now and even later, never underestimate just asking people you know to share it.
Yes.
You know, just if you have a dance friend, you say, "Hey, I wrote this." Never underestimate how helpful it is to ask people that you already know to share it.
Oh,
you know, sometimes you know, if you've written an article, just ask, five of your dance friends, "Hey, I just wrote this thing, would you share it?" People are really open to that if they actually know you.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, good luck.
Great, and thank you. We're going to go ahead and I'm going to put you on mute again. And if there's anybody else who'd like to ask a question, or if anybody who's already spoken had another one, feel free. You can press ** to unmute yourself. Questions, advice, your favorite takeaway, a crazy story about something you're writing or would like to write, we would love to hear from you.
Well, I'm going to jump in here now with another piece of advice for our last caller who asked about blogging. I want to recommend the podcast Pro Blogger. That's ProBlogger. He has a wonderful, let's see, what's his name? Can I remember? Darren? I don't remember his last name. But he's an Australian man who came into blogging from his subject was photography. But he had such a successful photography business that he started a blog coaching podcast. And it's so informative and it's so inspirational. So if you are starting a blog, there are hundreds of episodes, and many of them will help you come up with content, do social media marketing, and all the bloggy things you could ever imagine Darren covers in the Pro Blogger podcast.
Excellent. I'll include a link to that in the show notes as well.
Okay.
All right. It looks like that might be it for the questions. Well, thank you so much, Davina.
Oh, hey, I'm excited to see your new book. When you are getting ready to send it out for beta readers, please include me on your list. I'd be happy to read it and help you promote it.
I would love that. Thank you. All right. So letting everybody else know what's going on in the belly dance geek world, if practicing more is your New Year's resolution this year, we have a brand new do-it-yourself version of my group course, How to Build a Sustainable Practice Habit. You can get that right now and start today if you want to at bellydancegeek.com/store. And in the meantime, thank you everybody for coming. This is the end of our call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. We've got a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse folks. So when I send out an email with the call recording, I'll include a link to that group. If you've never been there before, there will be a slight delay while we approve you. We do confirm that each person that we add to the group is actually a belly dancer, just so we can have some privacy. So sometimes there can be a delay of a couple of days between when you ask and when we get you approved. And I will also include a link to Don's website, as well as to several of the resources that we've mentioned already. So if you're looking to head over to CreateSpace or to ProBlogger or to Davina's Facebook group, we'll have that available for you to click right into. All right. Our next call is not on the schedule yet, but I'm really excited about this topic. So I'm not going to tell you what it is yet. Just keep an eye on your inboxes and we'll send that off to you in a couple of weeks. And the last thing that I want to say is that this is the come on in kind of clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know somebody who'd like to join us, you can invite them to do so at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.